And good morning. This is a little unconventional, counsel, but I'm going to be presiding for this argument. As you're settling in, I will call our next case. And please correct me on the name. Is it Chazen? Chazen. All right. Thank you. So our next case is Thomas Chazen versus Kristen Chazen. And the case number is A231858. Appellant will have 15 minutes for argument this morning. Respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have an opportunity to present a five-minute rebuttal. You can make your arguments from the lectern in the center of the room, which is adjustable. We're making an audio recording of your argument this morning, and we're also live streaming the argument as well, just to ensure that our audio recording is clear. Please identify yourself and the party you are representing before you begin making your argument. And with that, I will turn things over to the lawyers. Counsel for appellant, get comfortable, and you may begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, Philip Gainsley for appellant Kristen Briggs. We're here, Your Honor, because twice the district court erred in denying Ms. Briggs an award of need-based attorney's fees, which this court sought to repair once before by mandate, which the district court then ignored. I say twice because the trial court erred both at the district court level and at this level, applying the same arguments. So I'm going to present my argument, the same conditions. I'm going to present my argument accordingly. And I say ignored because the district court was directed to make factual findings as required by the statute, and it did not do so. There are no factual findings from the district court.
I thought the district court found that your client failed to establish need.
That's not a finding.
Why is that not a finding?
A finding would be something like this, Your Honor. A finding would say, Briggs suffers from mental health and is under the care of several medical providers and consumes several prescribed medicines. Ms. Briggs maintains herself only through Social Security monthly payments of $2,300. In 2022, she was awarded a sum in a proceeding in which she was
impleted. No, I understand that those might be findings. My question is, why is it not a finding?
It's a conclusion.
That your client failed to produce sufficient evidence.
That's a conclusion. Frankly, I'm not even sure that's a conclusion. I think it's good for a memorandum. I think it's good for the history, but it's not a finding. And this court has said time and again that the courts must make findings of fact. Findings of fact are what result in the conclusions of law, that is to say, the order of this court. The court didn't even touch the findings of fact. The court said that we didn't show certain hypothetical things that the court created a list of. But that's not a finding of fact.
So then you would say that it's that the district court's conclusion then was erroneous because the facts compel a different conclusion?
It's erroneous because it wasn't based on any findings of fact.
Do the facts compel a different conclusion? And if so, what?
Oh, absolutely.
And what are those facts?
Absolutely. It's what I started reading you what the facts were. The conclusion drawn from those facts, Your Honor, would be Briggs is without funds to carry on this proceeding or to defend against Chazen's motions. Briggs shall have and recover from Chazen the sum of X for need-based attorney's fees. Those are the conclusions of law that a court could make based upon the findings. You got one of the things.
In responding to that exact allegation in her affidavit, doesn't the district court find that your client failed to disclose whether she owns real estate, vehicles, or stock? She didn't disclose how much money she has in her checking. She didn't disclose her life insurance or mutual funds. I mean, the district court is making findings with respect to the affidavit and saying that the allegations in the affidavit are not sufficient for the district court to evaluate whether she has need. And why aren't those findings?
Those aren't findings because they're not a matter of record.
The fact that your client didn't present that information is not a matter of record?
There's a lot of things that she could have produced. When a party says to a court, I need attorney fees because I live on only $2,300 a month. That's what I live on. It's different from what this court has recently talked about. For example, where someone sought attorney fees, where she was awarded $200,000 as a property settlement, was awarded $300,000 in child support payments. I'm talking about the Posley versus Duff case. Those cases had findings where the court could draw conclusions. What this judge did was simply to list, as I said earlier, a hypothetical situation, a hypothetical list. The statute and the cases don't require, Judge Larson, what you said.
The statute does require
a showing of need.
The statute and case law puts the burden on the moving party. The district court, it seems to me, as I read the district court's decision, was not persuaded by your client's oral testimony and felt it needed documentary support for those claims, which it didn't have. Is there, and I think there's some case law to support that approach. Do you say that the district court somehow abused its discretion by not being persuaded by the testimony?
If I could just correct the court respectfully, there was no oral testimony.
Well, affidavit. I mean,
under the general rules.
By testimony, I mean the evidence before the court that's testimonial. In this case, it was by affidavit. The district court wasn't persuaded by that.
Mr. Chazen himself did not argue that these weren't the facts. He never resisted. The only thing he said was that she didn't bring the matter in good faith.
Well, you're suggesting then that it's an affirmative defense. I mean, I think it's your client's burden as the moving party to convince the district court. And if that evidence is not there and the district court's, from the district court's perspective, I mean, we might reach a different conclusion, but from the district court's perspective, it's not a requirement by the other side to say anything further, is there?
Oh, I think our system is, if Mr. Chazen disagreed with the fact that Ms. Briggs was unable to afford attorney fees and that he was able with his $2 million in account, I think it's something that he should affirmatively state.
Is it required as a matter of law if your client has the burden and your client and the court's not convinced that your client has met the burden, is there some case law that suggests that some more argument is necessary from the other side?
I'm not sure that there's case law, but it's certainly reasonable to infer that he had no objection to it. When you're silent on the allegations, it seems to me you have no objections to it. All he's saying is that, well, at the district court level, that she did show need, and at this level, this is not a family court matter, so we shouldn't be in court in the first instance.
Mr. Gainsley, the district court also found that your client failed to establish that an award was necessary in order to make a good faith assertion of a right in the district court. And I'm not seeing that you're challenging that finding, but I want to confirm that there's no challenge there.
Frankly, I thought that was not an issue. That was
okay. Well, the statute, of course, does make it an issue. It's one of three criteria that a movement has to establish.
The first showing is that the fees are necessary for the good faith assertion of the party's rights.
Correct.
That's
yeah.
what you're referring
That's
to.
What I'm getting at.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Counsel argued that below, but the district court didn't say that there was no good faith. Nor did this
court.
Well,
in finding 18, the district court says respondent has not established that an award of fees is necessary for the good faith assertion of a party's rights.
You have to break that down. They're saying that we haven't shown good faith or we haven't shown need.
The district court didn't say.
Correct. What the statute says, though, is the district court shall, the mandatory verb shall, award fees if both
those are met. And the district court said that, at least together, that element wasn't met, that it's both parts. We don't know whether it's one or the other or both.
Yeah. Had there been proper fact findings, we probably would know. The point I...
But where does that ambiguity put us on in this?
I'm sorry?
Where does that ambiguity put us as we address your arguments?
I'm afraid it says go back to the district court and have the district court draw findings. What are the facts of the matter? Not the conclusion that she hasn't made a showing. That's not a fact finding. A fact finding is what the evidence reveals based on the record. Her needs, her medical disposition, what she lives on, that she has no cash other than that the cash she had was exhausted by a previous matter. And frankly, most importantly, that the money that she should have been awarded, that she was awarded, was never received. And I think we can't ignore that.
The district court also found that Mr. Chazen, that your client failed to prove that Mr. Chazen has the means.
Well, the record is from his own attorney, he's got $2 million on deposit at Morgan Stanley. I don't need to show any more than that. I mean, that's the record. That's not me talking.
$2 million in liquid assets?
Cash. Cash and cash equivalents. Yes. Yes. There was no contest about that. And as a matter of fact, it was his own Florida attorney who set that out.
And the district court was not persuaded that...
I just can't tell you why.
Well, the district court said why.
Not with the clarity that I would think.
Well, I think the district court said that, I mean, that wasn't sufficient. The district court was suggesting that there's two sides to the balance sheet. There are expenses. We don't know what those expenses are. And the district court listed some possibilities and wasn't persuaded that your client had met her burden to establish that he had the means to pay based on the possibility that of other expenses.
You know, that's a hypothetical laundry list of things that she might have shown, not that she was required to show, not that any case, statute, or rule says that she was required to show. And, by the way, and then I'll be seated.
But when we're looking at this, our standard of review is abuse of discretion, and so is it really whether she was required to show it or whether your client met her burden of persuasion to persuade the court that she had need for these attorney's fees and that the court is saying, I needed more. In order to feel that this standard was met. I mean, I'm not sure under an abuse of discretion standard that that's a legal error, right? I don't think that's a legal error. I think that we're in the clearly erroneous part of the abuse of discretion standard.
There are times when courts abuse their discretion, and I recognize that attorney's fees awards are discretionary with the district court.
Well, they're very discretionary, right? I think the case law is pretty clear that we're not supposed to.
But in the past 6 months, there have been several cases where the court has overruled the district court, either in finding that there is attorney's fees or finding that there should not be an award of attorney fees.
Can you reach the second part of the first element, which with regard to good faith? Given this, the staleness of the judgment that was originally at issue, on what basis would we conclude as a matter of law that the challenge on appeal to this court originally was made in good faith?
No court found that it was not in good faith. She had reasons, there were reasons that supported the delay. That doesn't mean there wasn't good faith. She discovered that she was awarded this money, never received this money, and made the motion. The court disagreed, but that by virtue of disagreement doesn't mean there wasn't good faith. And as a matter of fact, that is not the fact that she did not prevail.
Not good faith in her belief, but good faith in making the claim that her belief would be sufficient to overcome the untimeliness. Those are different issues, right? I mean, a person might have a good faith belief that, you know, I made a mistake.
Right.
But to make the legal argument that goes from there to, therefore, there's a basis to revive the stale judgment. Seems to be a different question.
I think there is no issue of good faith. I want to address one other thing.
And just to be clear, why is that as a matter of law? What case would you cite to support the good faith basis for the original appeal?
Actually, I did research that, and most of the cases that I've found deal with need and ability to meet the deed. Very few cases that I found, if I can think of any, dealt with the issue of good faith. And maybe I overlooked it because no court has said. This court didn't say it the last time we were here. The district court didn't say it when we were before the district court, that there was a lack of good faith. That just was not an issue. I do want to get to the final point. The district court also said that my affidavit under Rule 119 lacked corroboration. The rule doesn't require corroboration. If the framers of Rule 119 said the attorney shall, and then list things that the attorney must show, and have corroborating evidence, that's something else. But the rule didn't require corroborating evidence. It simply tells us what the affidavit of the attorney must say. We said it. I showed my bills. I showed the timekeeping.
We might be interpreting the district court's decision differently. I didn't think the district court was challenging the accuracy of your affidavit regarding your fees or the reasonableness of your fees, but the needing corroboration for the underlying allegation of need by one party and the lack of means by the other. I thought that's what the district court was focusing on.
I
misinterpreted it.
I think not.
Okay.
The court said, it devoted a paragraph saying that my affidavit lacked corroboration.
But I thought it was lacking corroboration on the elements of need.
No, I think of my disbursements and my services. And there need be no corroboration of that.
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Gainsley. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And next we will hear from counsel for respondent. Whenever you're ready, you may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Benjamin Court. I am here on behalf of the respondent, Thomas Chazen. With me at council table is our wonderful associate, Sarah Almquist. I think we need to reset the stage here to understand the context in which all of the arguments by appellant's counsel was made. The standard review here is abuse of discretion, and there's plenty of case law, including and not limited to the Schallinger v. Schallinger case, that says the determination to award attorney's fees rests almost entirely with the discretion of the district court. And here, the district court determined on all three elements that the appellant did not meet their burden of proof. Appellant attempts to shift that burden of proof, and you heard him say it here today, multiple times back on us. And that is just not the law. Appellant has the burden of proof on all three of the elements that they must establish, and that's the Phillips v. LaPlante case. One, that the fees were necessary for the good faith assertion of her rights. Two, that she lacks the means, not the income, but the means to pay her attorney's fees. And three, that the respondent had the means, again, not money in the bank account, but the means to pay her attorney's fees.
How do you interpret the district court's finding as to the first element, the need, needed the funds to make a good faith argument? Do you interpret it as the district court saying that there was not a good faith argument being made?
I absolutely interpret the district court's decision as there was not a good faith assertion being made here.
And what other language in the district court's decision would support
that? There was a specific finding on that. I don't have that at the tips of my fingers, but the district court definitely determined that because the judgment was stale, I mean, let's be frank here. This was a 16-year-old judgment that had not been renewed that was at issue. The law is crystal clear. The law, the case law, the statutes, there's no case law, to put it a different way, there's zero case law There is zero statutory authority. There are no rules that says a judgment somehow survives 10 years after its entry for whatever reason, unless it's renewed. So I do not believe that there was any good faith assertion being made here and that these fees were necessary. There were no rights to assert. Those rights had expired 6 years before this proceeding was brought.
But just to piggyback on Judge Ross's question, I think that maybe to put it, I guess what my concern is the district court makes the finding respondent has not established an award of fees is necessary for a good faith assertion as sort of a broad statement, and then has the sub-findings. But the finding with regard to the 16 years is 16 years elapsed between the entry of the party's judgment and this post-degree litigation. This significant lapse in time is important because the court cannot look to the allocation of assets contained in the decree to assess anything about respondents' present financial circumstances. And so I think that it's challenging to tie, and from what I can tell, that's the only finding that really relates to the timing aspect of this case. And I think it's hard to draw a direct line between the actual claim that was raised in the district court to that finding, because that finding seems more about your client's means as opposed to being a finding about the underlying litigation.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. To just bring this back, they have to prove all three elements. So perhaps that finding could be used for more than one of those things. The district court
failed all three. This court remanded the whole question of attorney fees on appeal to the district court. If it was so clear that there was no good faith, I mean, that's a question of law, I would suppose, almost entirely a question of law. I suppose there's some facts that might bear on it. But generally speaking, it would be a question of law whether or not the claim that was being raised on appeal, the challenge on appeal was made in good faith. Well, this court didn't say, wasn't certainly in the position to say, we're going to remand it to the district court for the district court's attorney's fees, but there's no need for the attorney's fees to be remanded to the district court if it was on its face lacking in good faith as an appeal. Am I correct about that?
I understand the argument. I'm certainly not here to criticize this court. I think it should have made that finding, and that was something that Judge Bryan and I went around and around at the last time we were here. I strongly was advocating for this court to make that legal finding because I think the law is pretty clear.
But the point is, in not making that I think argues against your case today. The fact that you made it clear that you were asking this court to reach that decision and this court didn't, doesn't that inform this panel as to whether or not we've already essentially implicitly rejected the idea that as a matter of law, the merit to the original appeal was lacking in good faith?
I understand what you're saying. Again, I will strongly disagree that a 16-year-old judgment there is any right to pursue that. I think that is clear under Minnesota Statute 548.09. It lasts for 10 years from the date of its entry. If it is not renewed, it's dead.
Right, because we have two different orders here, and the order with respect to the Court of Appeals fees is more specific.
That's correct.
Where the district court did actually dig in a little bit to what it meant by good faith and found that the Court of Appeals rejected her appeal, citing published authorities, including statutes and case law, and only remanded on this issue. But I do think that sort of piggybacks on this issue that appellants raise in their brief with respect to we've been pretty clear that just because you don't win doesn't mean that you didn't make a good faith assertion of your rights. And so what I've been wrestling with in this case with respect to this element is what is the distinction between a good faith assertion of your rights where you lose and a not good faith assertion of your rights where you lose? Like, what makes this into one bucket as opposed to the other?
No doubt that there is no doubt, and I'm not trying to stand up here and argue that this is a prevailing party issue. That is not what we're arguing, and that's, I don't believe, what the case law says. However, I believe they've mischaracterized that issue. Appellant has raised that issue in the context of, look, she didn't see it our way on that. The district court didn't see it our way on that because we weren't the prevailing party. That's not correct. I believe the district court was focused, particularly in the order on the appeal, that they were trying to collect on a stale 16-year-old judgment. And you can't assert in good faith rights on something that no longer exists
what
as a matter of law.
What if she had tried to collect on the judgment and nobody had opposed it on the ground that it was expired?
I would still take the position that it would have been an erroneous collection because it no longer exists. Rights can no longer be asserted under that. I'm not sure I'm understanding the question, but my answer would be I don't know that it matters if anyone would have contested it or not. It doesn't exist anymore. But we have three elements here. So, you know, this is a three-legged stool. You kick out one of the legs and the stool falls down.
Which is the weakest leg?
You may see it that way, and I'm not going to tell you.
No, I said which is the. I'm asking you which is the weakest leg. Yes.
I would think both the means issues are certainly the weakest links because I think the district court went out of its way to make very specific findings on those.
The appellant is arguing that the district court did go out of its way by creating arguments that weren't presented by your client. Is there merit to that?
I don't believe there's any merit to that at all. Here's the facts. Here's the record. She offered mostly conclusory statements and irrelevant items in her affidavit. The only specific things that were provided was that her current income is Social Security, and she provided a copy of her 2021 tax return. That's it. But means something more than income.
I think Judge Ross's question is focused on what did you argue below, not what was in her affidavit.
We didn't have to argue anything below. This is the appellant's burden of proof. They have to establish for the district court that she does not have the means and that my client has the means. We didn't have to prove
With regard to your client having the means, appellant is making the argument that the district court came up with hypothetical expenses that your client might have, but that no one ever asserted that your client does have. Well, is that an appropriate approach by the district court, and is that what the district court did?
That is appropriate for the district court, because under the La Pachelle v. Mitten case, evidence of what's in someone's bank account at a fixed point in time without evidence of that party's expenses does not meet the standard. This court has already decided these issues
many times.
But
how would appellant have gotten more up-to-date information? Because normally when it's a need-based fee case in family law, it's because there's a marriage disillusion happening or something is happening where there's a factual record being created with regards to what the means are of both parties, and so the district court is generally aware. Let's say that this had been something that had been brought within the 10 years, but there was some kind of deficiency, a claim that the appellant lost but maybe wasn't the timeliness of a judgment. And then brings a motion for attorney's fees, and it's been 9 years since the dissolution of the marriage, and so everything the district court has from the past is stale. How is the appellant supposed to get the information with regard to your client's means at that stage?
First of all, I think that makes my point, that in this case, this is a judgment arising from a property settlement. This is not a family law case. This is not about spousal maintenance. This is not about
Is this
child
your
support.
Argument about the five, sorry.
That is correct.
Hasn't 518.14, didn't this court already dispose of that case and that argument in the prior appeal?
That the court decided that.
And
I'm
so
preserving
isn't that,
that
wouldn't
issue.
That be law of the case for our?
Perhaps it would be, but I strongly disagree with that determination.
Assume it's the facts of the case.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Assume that, despite your objection, that we're bound by our prior court's decision on that issue.
Then to answer Judge Larson's question, There are many tools available to litigants to determine facts in a case. Those were not pursued here by the appellant. All they did was provide a self-serving affidavit.
So what are those means? In this particular proceeding, what would that process have looked like in order to determine your client's ability to pay or lack of ability
there
to pay?
There was zero argument made by the appellant below that they did not have sufficient facts, that they needed more time, that they needed more discovery. They've never made that argument throughout the case. We brought a motion to vacate the judgment. There are procedural rules that could have been taken to say, look, I'm going to be bringing this motion for attorney's fees in connection with this case, Your Honor. I request discovery. I request a scheduling order. There are lots of things that could have been done. They didn't do that. They tried to do this a different way, which was put in a self-serving affidavit and point to a bank account of my client. The record did establish that my client has very significant health issues and requires very significant and expensive medical care. That was never pursued. No questions were ever asked about that. You heard him say it today. The only thing they are pointing to is money in an account. Well, who knows if that money is there today? My client may not have the means to pay his attorney.
Well, they're pointing to money in an account and a judgment that was just never paid.
Well, that was hotly disputed, Your Honor, and we provided evidence to the district court of that. The district court didn't address that issue, and that's the district court's prerogative. We didn't just pursue vacation of the judgment based on the fact that it had expired 6 years before. I brought it in on other grounds as well, including but not limited to the fact that it was satisfied. The district court picked up on the fact that the judgment was void because it was more than 10 years had passed and it had not been renewed. That is the law of the case. And while I think there are other grounds upon which that decision could have been made to vacate that judgment, that's what the district court went with, and that was a logical and permissibly legal decision to make based on the facts that were presented.
I have one last question. Do you agree with appellant that a signed affidavit was later submitted? The district court, with regard to the district court fees, goes on and on to say that it was only an unsigned affidavit that was submitted. Do you agree with the appellant that a signed affidavit was eventually submitted and that you didn't contest the signed affidavit?
That is correct. The judge just didn't find that affidavit credible for a number of reasons, including but not limited to that it initially was not signed. A signed copy was later provided, but at the end of the day, the judge found that the information in that affidavit was not credible and did not meet the standard, and that was correct decision.
Well, I mean, the district court went to great lengths to explain that the affidavit was not signed and why that in particular made the affidavit not credible, and I'm wondering why that wasn't clear error if nobody objected to the later submission of the signed affidavit.
I think that was one of many factors that the district court relied on to determine that the affidavit was not credible. I don't think it was, as appellant attempted to argue, that it was immediately. There was a period of some time that passed, and I think at the end of the day, the district court just didn't buy what appellant was selling. And I think based on the record before that court, that was absolutely the correct decision.
All right, your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your argument, Mr. Cord. And we will turn things back over to Mr. Gainsley now for rebuttal.
Try not to repeat what I said, but I really can't help it, and if wish the court would indulge me for 1 minute. I've been doing this for many years. I have yet to see a party's affidavit that's not self-serving. Of course affidavits are self-serving. They're affidavits. They're of a party. They want to make a point. So, yes, the affidavit was self-serving, and we take no shame in that. If you go to the court's findings, what is it called, the court's findings, beginning at paragraph 13 and continuing on,
For the district court fees or the appellate court fees?
District court.
Okay.
It's all underlined because it's added. It's an amended order. Beginning at 13 is where it's underlined and where there's. I fail to see here any factual finding. There's the history of what's filed, and this court has said many times that a history of what's filed is not a fact finding. Then the court tells us what the law is. That's not a fact finding. There is no direct ask, but then in the same paragraph, the court says, we sought $14,000 in the district court and $9,000 in the Court of Appeals. It quotes Ms. Briggs, and we know from this court's other decisions, many decisions, that what a party testifies to is not a factual finding. It's what the party is testifying to. That doesn't belong as a fact finding. Paragraph 16, the court recites the law. Paragraph 17 is what you were just referring to, Judge Larson. And I might say that was a technical error on my e-filing. It was, as soon as it was called to my attention, we filed the exact same affidavit with the signature. And it was never an issue in the district court. Issue raised by counsel, issue raised by the district court. Again, in paragraph 18B, the court refers to the testimony of a party. That's not a fact finding. Then, as I said a moment ago, in paragraph C, there's a lot of things that she might have shown, but the fact that she didn't show doesn't demean the claim. And on and on. And then to the corroboration issues that I referred to earlier. There's no showing by statute, rule, or case law about corroboration. I'll conclude by saying, yes, we have the burden of proof, but when we make an assertion in an allegation, if it doesn't go answered, it's almost as if it's by default. Mr. Chazen made no arguments against what the claim was. He really defaulted on that. And yes, we have a burden of proof. We met the burden of proof.
Can I challenge just your theory under the fact-finding question?
Please.
When this court remanded, we said without findings, we cannot discern whether the district court determined that Briggs was not engaged in good faith assertion of her rights, or that she could afford to pay the attorney's fees, or that Chazen could not. And therefore, we sent it back for more findings.
Yes.
It seems to me we were asking the district court to make it a finding of those things, which you're calling conclusions, but which this court characterized as a deficiency in fact-finding.
I'm referring to this court's statement on that says, the district court has discretion to reopen the record to the extent necessary to make findings on whether Briggs has met the statutory elements.
Right.
The court didn't make findings. You directed the district court to make findings, and the district court did not make findings. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to the court, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame, which is 90 days. Thank you. And we will again pause to reconstitute the panel.